So I'm looking out at all of you and I'm thinking, oh, so much kindness, compassion in the room. I don't know about you, but I've been feeling very warm and soft after last week's talk about this kind of shared intention we have towards non-harm and goodwill, kind of caring about each other. Even in the midst of all this craziness, there's this softness that comes here. But with all this love, compassion, softness, there's still division. There's still this kind of disconnect, separation that shows up all the time. We can't really get away from it. One of the older Sangha members was reminding me about at Keystone, we hated the carpet. It stank. When we went to Beth Shalom, we could not get the chair stacked up right. We could not put that room back together. And of course, here we have little slots for the shoes. But at Beth Shalom, it was just an entryway. So we don't think about the shoes. So we would come in and just, you know, throw our shoes off. And there'd be like this mound of shoes everywhere. The security there was having a fit that the shoes were not orderly like they are back there. Then we go to Bloedel Hall, bigger space. Don't have to worry about the chair so much. No carpet. The door would creak every 2 minutes. Somebody would come in. It's like we could have somebody that's there wait a moment, because the person's in the parking lot and they're just gonna come up right behind you. But nope. We'd have this creaking door every 30 seconds. I mean, there's just no getting away from this division. It's all around us all the time. And in some respects, we're not really just loving, kind, compassionate people sitting together. That's more like a social group, which is not what we are. So that division, whatever that is, that division, practicing, investigating, looking into that division, that's what makes us Sangha. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. Like, how do we do that in a way that makes us Sangha and it doesn't tear us apart? So I start with the definition, because I always go to Webster, so I know what I'm talking about. So you know what I'm talking about. And basically, for division, there is like a long laundry list of things. But ultimately, let's say it is this idea of separating things into different parts. So we have a hand. We don't just see it as the hand, the whole, the hand. We see it as the palm and the fingers. And then, of course, the fingers are divided up into the thumb, the pinky, the ring finger. We are just forever dividing in the mind, this dividing aspect that we have. But that dividing aspect that we have is basically a natural aspect in the mind. It's a natural part of the way the mind is. It calculates. That calculating kind of aspect that we have in the mind is normal, and it's natural, and it's not going to go away. So if our idea is that somehow or another, we are going to stop that dividing. Get rid of the division so it's not there. Then we're kind of going down the wrong road, wrong view. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes here. Alice Walker. We're going to stay with our African-American theme here. She said, in nature, nothing is perfect and everything is perfect. So somehow or another, is there a way that we could begin to talk about, inquire into division as if it is perfect and not perfect at the same time? Could it be okay that our division is, you know, not okay and okay at the same time? If we didn't have that calculating aspect of the mind, we wouldn't have mathematics and science, and much of our language and things that we depend on, it comes from that idea of being able to divide. It gives us a lot of strength. It's the intellect. But there's another part of dividing that maybe it's a little bit more problematic, because it's not just in the dividing. It's in this kind of comparing mind, this measuring and evaluating, judging. Which is better? What is better? These preferences, biases, prejudices that we have that get a little bit more sticky. I have a friend who's a monastic. And one thing good about monastics, you can always, if you can get them to go, take them for a meal, Donna. So we went to get something to eat one time. And he asked me out of the blue, what is it when you like something you see? I don't know. He said, well, what if you see something you don't like? Okay, I don't like it. So I guess he's testing me, and I didn't know he was testing me, he says. Okay. What if you hear something you like? What is that? I said, it's probably going to be beautiful if I like it. He said, well, what if you hear something you don't like? What is that? I said, clearly there's something I'm supposed to get. It's like going over the head, missing it. He said, do you ever notice when you like something, when you like something you hear, when you like something you see, do you notice when you don't like something you hear, don't like something you see? Or do you just notice you like it? Or you don't like it? And I thought about this, right? I don't know what that is. He said, that is the nature of greed. When we like something, that is greed in the mind. When we don't like something, that is aversion, hatred in the mind. Well, think about that. All that music that you like, that's greed in the mind. Seems kind of strange, because I just like the song. All the music you don't like, I have a brother that loves Western country music. Going to his house is difficult. He has this major sound system that's all through the house. So whatever song is playing, it's playing everywhere. He can't miss a note. He loves it. I don't. What is that? Sound is sound. What we see is just what we see. But there is something in us that decides, in the mind that decides, this is good sound. I like this sound. This is good taste. I like this. This is bad taste. I don't like that. Something within us made a choice in every single spot we're sitting in. Something happened. There's a division that automatically happens, and we don't do anything. We don't do that. There's no me doing that. There's the mind making divisions, deciding things, comparing, choosing for us. So if you start with this premise, my friend, when he asked me that, it seemed very strange because I thought of greed as the grasping aspect of greed, not just the idea that I would like something or I wouldn't like something. So, George Washington Carver said, when you can do the common thing in life in an uncommon way, you will command the attention of the world. And in some respects, that is exactly what we are doing here. The idea that we would even question into the mind around our likes and dislikes is so uncommon. It is not the nature or our society or culturally what we do. What we do is that we begin to move towards our likes and avoid the dislikes. So if I don't like a particular type of music, I just avoid it. I don't actually listen to it. If I don't like something, I don't go towards that. I just let it be. Just go the other way. I like trees. So I like walking ways that are going to lead me down the path to a lot of trees. And sometimes up on Capitol Hill, there are some streets that have trees just hovering over the center of the street, and in the summertime they're just beautiful. So now I'm watching how I walk down certain ways, go down this road and then turn here and then go there, and I notice that I keep walking on the blocks where the trees are the most magnificent, and I avoid the blocks where there's not too many trees on them. Take a moment and think about the implication of this. If we change the color in this room, some people will have a lot of tension. Some people won't bother them at all. If we don't change the color, some people might have a lot of tension with that. Some people happy. What I'm hoping we can talk about tonight is more about how to notice the comparing mind. What my monastic friend said, Vimala said, that it is in the not seeing that's the problem. It's not the liking. And it's not the disliking. It's that I don't know that I'm liking or disliking. I don't know that I'm leaning towards something, making a choice towards this. The practice is in the paying attention to that's what I'm doing. It's in the paying attention to my likes, paying attention to my dislikes, so that I know I'm leaning into it. I know that there is a liking. There's a greed in the mind towards something. And that inevitably means I am disliking something else. It's beginning to actually practice with that. Here's why that is really important. Because the more we stay just following our likes, following our dislikes, or avoiding our dislikes, the more conditioned we become around certain things. And the more conditioned we become, the more we act out of that conditioning. The more habitual we become. And then the mind's evaluation of life, things in life, whatever's happening, becomes the go-to energy that we have. And then all of a sudden, you walk into the room and the mats are orange. And you're like, ah, orange, who did that? And the entire time you're sitting, instead of just ignoring the mats like we normally do, because they're green, we're used to them, and who cares? You just keep looking at the mats. Like, what is the problem with that? Why did we do that? Whose idea was it to get orange mats? I mean, that's just crazy. Nobody buys orange mats. And on and on and on. Because we become so conditioned to seeing things a certain way that we don't even show up anymore. We only show up when something goes wrong. And then we wake up to get it back. Get it back right again. So if we talk a little bit about the comparing mind, that's where most of our difficulties lie. I don't watch sports. I'm not a sports person at all, but I live in a family full of sports fanatics, so I've learned some of the names of the people. I actually know who they are and what they did. Michael Jordan is one of those people. So he said, I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the winning game shot and missed. I failed over and over and over again in my life. And that is why I succeed. That's kind of an uncommon way of looking at something. That you succeed in the failure. And in some respects, that's what we do here in Sangha. We are not looking for the world that doesn't have any divisions. We're actually looking into the world for the division. We are looking into the comparing mind to see it for what it actually is, where it comes from. Why is that there? Why do we have all those? We're trying to see our conditioning, our habitual ways of reacting and relating to people, things. For instance, when I first started practicing, when I was in Bloedel Hall, we stayed at Bloedel Hall for a long time, and so when I was in Bloedel Hall, I used to sit on the second row, right in the middle. Second row, perfect spot. Just protected enough, shielded from Rodney. But yet, right up front. And I loved it. I sat almost in the exact same seat every week. And if I happened to come in and notice someone in my seat, it would be problematic. I would try to sit right next to them and maybe spread out so they would feel uncomfortable. Maybe scoot over one seat more. I just had to sit in that seat because that was my seat. And we moved there and went to Spirit Center for Spiritual Living. And then we were in kind of like some kind of an auditorium. I mean, it was a sanctuary, but it had the feel of an auditorium. And the seats were those kinds that are bolted together down in the front. I hated those seats. So I sat in the back where they had straight back chairs. All of a sudden, I don't like the front anymore. Sit in the back, in the straight back chairs. I like that. Now I sit in the back. I like it. I never noticed these things until my friend Vimala started pointing out all the likes, right? I'm thinking about all these things that I like and I just take for granted now. So just think about it. I do make a choice between whether I sit up front or whether I sit in the back. Seems kind of not a problem, but it is a choice. But it's not just the choice that we make. It's not just that in the comparing mind. That's the kind of the I like, I dislike. It seems kind of not too difficult, not too problematic. But it can get kind of ugly. There's another layer to this simple little thing. That's more leaning towards the mind's evaluative kind of ways of being, the judging way that we are. This comparing mind that gets caught in what's called conceit. Not conceit. When we think of someone as being conceited, we have a tendency to think, oh, they're kind of arrogant, think they're all of that. And there's some arrogance in conceit. But conceit under Buddhist teaching is directed more like thinking you are superior, which we kind of all think of, but also thinking that you are inferior, or thinking, well, we're just the same, we're equal. All three of those are a measuring mind, conceit in the mind. So when I first started practicing here at SIMS, I mean, I practiced for a good 10, 12 years by myself. But when I came into a sangha, and there's a bit of that coming into a sangha, you begin to measuring up with people. And I remember every once in a while in a sit, I'd open my eyes and I'd look around, see what everybody's doing. Am I still enough like everybody else? It's like this mimicking, trying to be like everybody else. I kind of judged my sits based on what the mind thought. If I felt like I was like everybody else, I'm good meditator. If I felt like I'm too wiggly because I had so much anxiety, I'm always moving all the time and I can't be still, I'm bad meditator. You know, this kind of measuring up to the point where when I felt like I was equal with everybody else, now I'm okay. In Sangha, we tend to do that. We tend to look around at each other, kind of measuring up, see if we're okay. And that conceit in the mind drives this energy of judging and comparing, trying to decide if we're as good as or not as good as someone else. But along with that comes some other energies. Along with this kind of am I as good as? Am I better than? Am I less than? Comes a lot of jealousy and envy. You get boastfulness and pride. These are things we don't really like to talk about because it has a little bit more of an edge to it. It can be a little bit more hurtful when we come bumping up against each other. I will never forget something I saw in a meditation hall that was striking to me when I saw it in someone else. And then I've actually seen it in myself, sort of my scooting over in my chair. But there was a woman during one of the walking meditations at this retreat, this one of the yogis. I guess her seat that she was in wasn't working out very well, so she wanted to move, and she went up to the teachers, and somehow she had a conversation. And I'm just sitting here doing the walking meditation, watching, not walking. And I watched the teachers go over and kind of assess where they were going to put this person and kind of move some cushions aside and rearranged a few things, put her little cushion there. She sat down, tried it out. Great. Got up, went and did her walking. And I'm just sitting, watching. And then the walking period ended. And one of the seats that were right there, to make her spot, they had to push another person's cushion to the side. And it kind of threw that yogi out of alignment from where the seat was. He noticed that when he hit the door coming in. He stomped, and I say stomped because I was sitting in the back of the hall, big giant hall, and I heard his footsteps from the moment he hit that door all the way across the floor. He took her stuff and tossed it. I kid you not, tossed it aside, put his stuff right back, lined it all back up again, and sat down peacefully. Calm. So people started coming in. They're all sitting around, getting their spots. Everybody's kind of sitting down. No one really knew that this cushion that was kind of tossed in the middle of the floor actually belonged to someone. And then I watched this woman walk in and like stand there wondering what to do. Like, what do I do? She picked up her stuff. It was so sad. And I could feel the sadness. I wanted so bad to get up and say, he did that! Well, I did it. I did it. I just sat there feeling the sadness and sense of something's not right here. This feeling, something's not right. It's noble silence. You're not saying anything. I could never, up until this moment right now, I've never told anyone that. I've held this thing for many years, over 10 years. But it was so painful watching her stand there, not knowing what to do. Feeling like somebody had seriously offended her, but who did it? Everybody's sitting in their spots now. Time for the meditation. We're all quiet. Even the person that came in, threw her stuff to the side, he didn't mean any harm. There's no difference in that and me trying to scooch over so that people won't take my second row seat. It's the same energy. It is that part of the mind that thinks that's mine. This is my stuff, my seat, my place. So we don't always notice that. We don't always notice that energy that's there. But it's there. Cicely Tyson, who's some of you might know, she's an actress, says, challenges make you discover things about yourself that you never really knew. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to see stuff about ourselves. We're trying to see who we are. We're trying to see that throwing somebody's stuff aside. We're trying to see that. Not just throw it aside, but somehow or another feel it. And we're all trying to notice, if we can, that somebody's stuff is just sort of piled up here, and why would that be like that? How did that happen? It wasn't like that when I went on my walking meditation. Frederick Douglass says, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. So how do we see this comparing mind? How do we see our likes and our dislikes that just sort of show up? Our choices that we make, our evaluations, our wants, don't wants. How do we see that? We see it in the hindrances. We see it when we start feeling that aversion, when we start feeling that desire, there's that twinge of gotta have it. Start feeling averse towards something. Start feeling a little restless, worrying, not, this isn't quite right, something's wrong. Or we're bored. Dullness in the mind, not really paying attention, kind of like show up to Sims just to show up because this is what I do on Tuesday. We see it in paying attention to that doubt, paying attention to that instead of just reacting to it, we are trying to pay attention to it. So, a while ago, my group up in Capitol Hill, we've been looking at relationships. And so I called Greg Kramer up, who's a teacher for Inside Dialogue. He is, like, to me, the guru of relationship. So I asked him, what is the big deal about relationships, right? Okay, I know that it's important. I should work with it, but I want to know, why is it so important? Why is it so important that we work with relationships? And he said, which I will never forget, how are you going to know you're arrogant, Tuwari? How are you going to know you're being cruel and mean if it's not for relationships? How are you going to know when you're causing harm, stepping on people, overlooking people, not paying attention? How are you going to know that? We see that in our relationships with other people. We see that when we bump into each other. That's how we see it. But if I'm so busy looking at other people saying, get out of the way, you're in the way, you're causing harm, move away, then we can't see. We can't see who we are, what we're doing. We have to bump into each other. We have to have some kind of a moment when we notice the comparing mind. And we're going to notice that comparing mind not when everything is going smooth. We're going to notice the comparing mind when things are not going smooth, when something has askew, something's wrong. That's when we're going to wake up and say, hey, what's going on? Something's changed. Oprah Winfrey said, real integrity is doing the right thing knowing that nobody's going to know whether you do it or not. So what that means is, think of all the opportunities I missed in practice when I saw somebody in my seat. Instead of noticing the my seat, I noticed, you gotta get out of that seat. Try to upset the cart a little bit so that you don't get in that seat next time. Instead of noticing that I'm selfing around that seat. And in fact, there was some couple of people I knew back at Bloda Hall, they would never sit in the same spot. I mean, every time I would look for them, I'd see them over there. They're over there. I thought, that is a great way to sit. I can't do it. But that is a great way. The thing is, can we just notice that that's what we're doing? Can we notice the minus about something? Even in this sangha, can we notice the minus that gets caught in this sangha is mine and this is the way it should be? You start bringing in new people, you're going to bring in new ideas. Can we notice that we have all this aversion and greed around whether we talk or not? Just bring that up. Should we talk or not talk? And there's so much division as to what it should be. I don't know whether it's right or wrong, talking, not talking, I don't know. But it is a big deal in practice in a lot of our centers and sanghas about whether we should have silent breaks or no silent breaks. Think of all of the greed in the mind about wanting more diversity to be at SIMS. Oh, we just need more people of color here. That would make it perfect. It'd be so much better. I can't tell you how many white people come to me and say, oh, I wish there was more people of color here. Like, I don't know if that's true. Because I assure you, if there were way more people of color, our Tuesday nights would not look like this. There would be some differences. It's not that you could just bring a whole bunch of people of color in and we're all going to sit quietly. Something would begin to change. Not a right or a wrong, but just because it's different. It's not the same. And then the question is, would we be working with noticing our aversion? Or would we just stomp across the room, grab this thing, the cushion, toss it to the side, and go back to doing the way it's supposed to be, the right way? It says, Audre Lorde, who's a poet, activist, says, when I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of a vision, then it becomes less and less important about whether I'm afraid. And what I'm saying in terms of afraid, what I'm thinking or pointing to, is that if we begin to think of this much larger vision, it becomes less and less important if I feel aversion, and more important that we help each other see that and work through it. It's not the aversion, it's the working through it. It's the seeing it, being okay with it. Being okay with someone else's aversion so that they can work through it. Being okay with someone else's desirous wanting it to be this way, even if you don't want it to be this way, just so the two of you can work through it. Okay, so we're going to turn the corner. want to tell you a few analogies. I like analogies so I can think. What is it that vision looks like? And then I want to turn towards how do we cultivate this Dhamma? How do we cultivate this way of working with the vision as a gift, as a grace, and not as some problem that we need to solve? So, I'm laying in my bed thinking to myself, what is the best way for me to describe or identify the insidious nature of division? It's natural and it's insidious. And then it came to me. Infant fingernails. I know there's some people in here with some babies around. You can clean an infant's fingernails. And you can clip them, clean them. I'm talking infants like 2 months. And it's like they grab dirt out of the air. They just grab it and it's back again. It's this constant cleaning of fingernails. The lint, the dirt, it just gathers up all the time. I don't even know where it comes from. They're protected. They're shielded in these little bundles and things. Where do they get it from? But anybody that has any children, you know what I'm talking about. It just comes out of thin air. And it's always there. There's not going to be a time when you finally cleaned out the nails and got the little fingers opened up and got all the lint out that they've grabbed. It's coming back. Tape dispensers. You know how you have your little tape dispenser and all of a sudden dust and dirt get on the tape? So you always sort of have to get the first pieces, that's the trash, and then get the tape that you want. Cholesterol in our arteries. Right? So you can do all these things to lower your cholesterol, but cholesterol is sticky and it is going to cling to each other. And some people, the cholesterol clings more than others. But it is a part of being human, this collecting of cholesterol in our arteries. The point I'm trying to make is, if we are trying to live in a world where there's not going to be any division among us, where there's not going to be any division out there, we are looking for the wrong world. That's some kind of utopian place. And I don't know if I really want to be there. I don't know if I want to be in a place where everybody thinks, looks, and acts the same. I don't know if I want to do that. Maybe it's because I've been so different for so long. I'm not even going to say anything about that. Thurgood Marshall said that none of us got where we are solely by pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. None of us got to where we are solely by pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. We got here because somebody, a parent, a teacher, an Ivy League crony, or a few nuns bent down and helped us pick up our boots. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for each other. In fact, one of the things that we talked about in the Capitol Hill Sangha is the idea that if you really want to work on your practice And if our practice is about turning towards the difficult, then the people we should be the most appreciative of are the people that give us the most difficulty. They're the ones that are helping us in our practice more than anybody else. So, all right, how do we cultivate this? How do we bring this into the Dhamma and bring it onto the path in a way that we can stay with it? At first, I used to have a lot of difficulty, unpleasant emotions. I think from the moment Rodney announced that he was going to retire, even though I knew it was coming, I had all this unpleasant emotions up and down, all over the place. But then I got to thinking more and more. Sometimes when I come and I listen to Tim, I listen to me, I'm thinking, we are so different, right? Think of the beauty in that. Think of what would happen if you begin to practice every week and you listened and noticed how come when Tuareg talks, when Tim talks, it's great. How come when Tim talks, Tuareg talks, it's great. What is that? Same Dhamma. Doesn't matter whether I say it or Tim say it. We do say it differently, but it's the same Dhamma. What's that choice that's going on in our heads? We can see that better when you have two different teachers. Teaching styles that are very, very different. You can see it much better. I think about all the differences that are going to happen with us. It just happens. One, there's a huge difference between being here in this, I didn't even think of this as the South End, but being in the South End versus being in the North. I didn't think of Bloedel Hall as the North, but clearly the North Enders thought that Bloedel Hall was better. Something about what is that bridge called? Ship Canal Bridge. Something about the Ship Canal Bridge drastically changes everything. But that means we might see more South Enders, more West Seattle people who couldn't get all the way to Bloedel Hall. Who knows? It could be a completely different makeup, a different energy in the room. Something to practice with. Let's see if I have a quote. He who is not courageous enough to take risks will accomplish nothing in life. That would be Muhammad Ali. His life was so inspiring. He kind of turned towards the difficulty. So anyone here can be loving and kind and compassionate. Any one of us, anytime. It's not what makes us special. It's our willingness to turn and look for metta in the midst of difficulty. That's what's uncommon. That's what makes us Sangha. Anyone can wait out hard times. You know, we can have hard times, or we can just wait it out. Be patient. But it's our willingness to turn into that difficulty, turn into it, and help each other turn into it that makes us Sangha. Any one of us could do some kind of self-help program and we could become really, really nice people, very generous, very kind. I know, I've done a lot. But it is our willingness to see our shortcomings and to see the shortcomings of other people, see it as shortcomings, that makes us Sangha. We sort of have to do this together. We have to see each other and see ourselves in each other in order for us as a group to help us keep turning towards the investigation of division, the investigation of our wants and our likes and our dislikes and our don't wants. We are the only ones that are going to help us do this. Because when we go out into the rest of the world, that is not the nature of things. You just think about it. You tell any one of those people that don't practice, I am going to start working on noticing why I like something. I'm going to notice the hatred when I don't like something. I want to know what happens when I like something and when I don't like something. Just see what happens. Sort of like when you come home from a retreat. What did you do? Okay, but to do this, we have to spend time together. I read a sutta when I was studying for this. And the Buddha kept reminding people that you have to spend time together. A long time, not a short time. So when we spend time together, we begin to see each other more clearly. We don't necessarily know it when we first get here. New people to the Sangha may not necessarily know who we are. But over time, as we practice together, begin to share our lives together, we can see things. So through being together week after week after week, even with our divisions, we can see the quality of each other's hearts and intentions. We could begin to see that, not just because there's no division, but we can see it through that. Through the volunteering with each other, doing things together, we could begin to see that we could depend on each other in our words, our conducts. We can connect with each other. We can feel safe to relax and be with each other. Through adversity, we learn to trust each other. We need some of adversity so we can trust each other, because we see that we go through this together. And we sit and we talk, we share our wisdom together. That's how we learn, that we learn the wisdom from each other, from our discussions and our talking to each other. Desmond Tutu said, "My humanity is bound up in yours, for we can only be human together." That's what we're kind of trying to do here. We're trying to somehow live this human life together. It's bound up in division. It is impermanent. It's subject to change. It's not personal. This is probably the hardest week I have had in a long time. I cannot believe how much I felt like I was just like the people in the guys that got shot. Sometimes I don't feel like I'm like them. But for some reason, this week, these stories felt like just regular people like me. Like my sons. I don't think I ever have been quite so afraid. And then about 3 days ago, I had this dream. I had this dream that I was stopped by a cop, and I was so scared. I mean, I have been working with cops for years, 25 years I've worked with police. But I was so scared, and it just so happened that I got stopped with someone who was a part of the Sangha. And that person spoke for me. So I'd like to, I know there's a lot of things like, what do we do? What's going to happen? I want to leave you with something. Something that I realized when I was there in this dream. This is kind of an uncommon way, but we are required to speak up for each other. It means people of color have to speak up on behalf of white people who do right, who are allies, who understand and try to understand and be aware. It means white people have to speak up on behalf of people of color. It's beginning to recognize that we can't leave the other to deal with their own problem. We sort of have to do it on behalf of them. I realized I can't speak up on behalf of myself. I sound like an angry black woman. It doesn't matter how nice I say it. It's going to sound like I'm an angry black woman. You could say it, and it sounds completely different. If you tried to speak up on behalf of yourself as a white person who cares about what's going on, it's going to sound like, ah, that's superficial. You're just saying that. But if I say it on your behalf, something changes in the mix. Something happens. That's what I think we have to do, is speak on behalf of each other so that people know that we're not carrying this load alone. Thich Nhat Hanh, who is the Buddhist social change person, he said, "You are me and I am you. Isn't it obvious that we are inter-are? You cultivate the flower within yourself so that I will be beautiful. I transform the garbage within myself so that you will not have to suffer. I support you, you support me. I am in this world to offer you peace. You are in this world to bring me joy." That seems like a nice place to stop. Okay, I have greed in the mind. I love this Sangha. You got greed in the mind too? So I don't think we have questions. I don't think we have announcements, so we can take some questions or comments if someone has any. Thank you. Yeah, yours too. Yes. Did everybody hear that?
No.
She was saying, what do I think about this why? What about not going into the why? Why do I like this? Why do I don't like this? You know, what about just being a little bit more quicker and just kind of letting it go, right? Is that what you're saying? Just, you know, letting it go. I think that would be more what Vimala was saying. Not so much of the investigating why, as much as it was, he was not asking me, why did I like things? He was asking me, what was that? So it's more of noticing that that liking does not mean the thing that you like is good. It is greed. So it's noticing the liking. That's all it is. It's not so much of a, you know, the investigation is what we do. And so it's sort of when you're in your meditation and you're practicing, you can notice and investigate the nature of the mind's greed or aversion much easier. But when you're just sort of going about your life, that's what his point was, is to notice that you like something, that the liking is not inherent in the thing. It is inherent in the greed in your mind. So it's beginning to see that, that there's something that tells you to like something. You don't just like it. That's what he's saying. So it's more, I think, along the lines of what you're saying. You know? Anybody else? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And is the object of the lesson to be just noticing that we find things beautiful, we see that, and not being enough? I'm getting it.
Yes.
I put on a shirt that I think is pretty as opposed to a shirt that I think that is not going to be.
Right. Right. That's exactly what he's saying. Her question was, or her comment was also, so what about this idea of the beauty, you know, creating gardens that are beauty, me walking down streets that are beautiful because they have trees there, and just sort of like picking the things that it's like, are we supposed to not love beauty and then move away from that all the time? Is that sort of my paraphrasing it? That's right. No, I'm not saying it's not a good thing. It's fine. It's just that art that you're looking at is not what is beautiful. It is the mind's evaluation of that that's beautiful. And that's fine. Because as long as you and I are sitting there looking at this piece of art saying, oh, this is beautiful, no problem. But then if you say, this is beautiful, I'm like, that is ugly. That is ugly. No, that is beautiful. Division happens. And we cannot see that division is unnecessary because my saying it is beauty is strictly from my own mind. That's what he's saying. You begin to look that the evaluation of something as beautiful is coming from you. It's not that certain streets are beautiful. right? But I can enjoy walking down the street with the trees. It's knowing that I'm making this evaluation, right?
Thank you. That's
yes. Mm-hmm.
And to be aware of the attachment to the aesthetic.
Yes. There, she said that there's an attachment and to be aware of that attachment to the aesthetic. And I think that's what he's pointing to. That's how you're aware of it, is to see that. I mean, if you see that, think about it. This is where the logical conclusion comes, right? If you see your attachment to something you like, then if somebody comes along and doesn't like it or takes it away or it changes, can you see where the cessation of suffering shows up? Because you're not following along trying to get it back. You can see, it's like Ajahn Chah's saying that he loves his cup, but he knows it's already broken when he's drinking his tea, right? He already knows. And when you hold life that way, like, you know, this is my opinion. I have a calendar in my house that I make pictures out of, calendars with great sayings on them. And one of them is, there are no facts, only interpretations. So if you could see life that way, right? If you could see this is just an interpretation, this is just an opinion, this is not fact, then you could see the futility in arguing.
Yeah. Can I add one more thing? So when I'm experiencing aversion, I see it, and then an expression of equanimity can arise. But I haven't heard you. Is that, you know, is that where that's leading, or does, you know, that happens?
Mm-hmm. She said that.
Arising?
Yeah. She said that when she notices aversion, if she just notices it, there's this sense of equanimity that arises. That is.
Yeah, sometimes when I'm investigating it, that
right.
can happen. Correct.
Right.
I mean, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that is the practice. I'm not saying that that's not what you do. I'm saying that's it. Is that you just be with the aversion and see what happens, rather than trying to get rid of the aversion or this idea that somehow aversion is bad. We have this idea that greed, hatred, that's bad. It's not. It's just the nature of mind. It's always there. And I think when Vimala asked me about things I like and things I don't like if I hear a sound and I like it, I hear a sound, I don't like it, I never thought of that as greed in the mind. Right? It's not that it's bad or, oh, now I can't even listen to my favorite song anymore because I'm just going to be sitting there thinking there's greed in the mind. Some of us are a little obsessive about this. And I'm just one of those people that analyze everything. But the idea, I think if you're monastic, you're going to be a little bit more get into the minutia, but the idea for us as householders, lay practitioners, is what would the world look like if we had equanimity around aversion? Right? Because we're averse all the time. But what if we didn't have that tension to get rid of it? What if we could begin to relax with it? And it's not that aversion isn't unpleasant, uncomfortable. But we could learn to hold the uncomfortable, the unpleasant, with this equanimity that you speak of. And I think that is the nature of equanimity. If we get still with something that's uncomfortable, equanimity, compassion is what arises to help us hold it. We just have to get still with it first. And then the heart kicks in and helps us hold it. Well, we probably... Can I take that afterwards? Good, we probably should stop here. I want to check to see. Okay.